Cameron Schwab has been the CEO of Richmond, Fremantle and Melbourne at 24 years of age. When he started as CEO of Richmond, he was the youngest ever in that role in the history of the game. He now helps develop leaders through his business design CEO, and Cameron is also a very talented illustrator, which you can see in his book, More Than a Game, which you can download from his website.
Okay, no, it's a pleasure. I'm really glad we've had this opportunity, and I think we've got plenty to talk about. I think we could take this in any one of a number of directions, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it sounds like we've definitely got a common interest in football. Yes. So what's your story? How did you fall in love with footy yourself?
I think I fell in love with... I don't know if I fell in love with football so much. I fell in love with the Richmond Football Club. I fell in love with the Tigers, I think, before I probably fell in love with anything in life, I would say. And it was... It was always in the background of my life. My father, Alan Schwab, was secretary of the Richmond Football Club when I was growing up, and it was glory days for the Tigers. And so there was always that noise in the background. But his brother, Frank, umpired a grand final. So he umpired the 1961 grand final, and Frank's son, Peter, played for Hawthorn and coached Hawthorn. So it was very much part of our... it was very much in our family. And because it was an unusual surname, the first time I can ever remember having any sort of sense of identity of myself other than my given name was being asked whether I was any relation to either the umpire or to that bloke at Richmond. And and then I went and watched a game in the early 1970s. Richmond were playing at the MCG, and I remember walking up the stadium steps, holding my father's hand, seeing the noise, the colour, and falling in love, I think it was. And I think it was that same sense of falling in love that you get to experience, throughout your lifetime. And that was my first real experience of that emotion.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people I speak to, their connection to football is through their father.
Yeah. And it was a pretty powerful one too, because it was... And I got to, in many ways, I had like this almost Disneyland childhood for someone who did love the game, but it was also quite a complicated childhood with the game as well, because I got to see, even at a very young age, and then got to experience, obviously, through my working life, that the game does not give up its rewards easily in lots of ways, and it can also be bring out the best and worst And that might be related to the fact that people do love it. We tend to be at our best and worst when it comes to love anyway. And I saw that and experienced that right from the very outset. And I saw the wonderful glory, because there were mornings where I'd wake up, probably three or four mornings of my childhood, where I'd wake up on a Sunday morning and the Premiership Cup that the Tigers had won the day before was sitting in our family room in our suburban house in Mount Waverley. And then there were days, where... I realised, that the difficulties of the decisions where, my father was dealing with the football mortality of some of the heroes, my childhood heroes, and having to bring them around to our home to explain to them that they were no longer players at the club. And so I saw all of those elements. I saw the kryptonite of my superheroes, if you like, right from a young age.
I do love that analogy that with our best and worst when we're in love. You've had a long career in football. What are some of your highest points, but also you've certainly had your fair share of challenges?
The highest points, I think the feeling of major breakthroughs, I still feel as though that was the best time. And sometimes they were the ones that you got to share publicly. Like I was at Melbourne, I was the recruiting manager at Melbourne Football Club, and we made our first finals for the first time, our first finals in 23 years from 1964 to 1987. And I was the recruiting manager during that period of time, therefore had played a role in the recruitment of a number of the players, and a few of them were quite unfashionable. And it was also at the time when the Irish boys, Jimmy Steins and Sean White, were playing. And so that was a pretty special period to be involved with, where you got to see two and three generations of Melbourne supporters you know, go to the game together to watch their team play in a final for the first time in their life. So that was a wonderful thing. I was involved at Richmond when we did the SOS campaign, when the Save Our Skins campaign, which really, at the time, without putting too fine a point on it, was probably the difference between the club surviving and not surviving. You know, I'm not sure how it would have played out had we not have had the success with that.
We might have merged with Hawthorn.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk, obviously, about that. I think it was probably, you know, it was clubs like Fitzroy and North Melbourne and Melbourne, you know, all of them were being talked about. And it was just prior to that Western Bulldogs, Fitzroy merge, and then obviously years later the Melbourne Hawthorn merge, of which then I was the CEO immediately after that. So there was that complicated time in the history of the game. And then I was at Fremantle when we made the finals for the first time ever. So there's been I think they're the collective experiences that you got, when I say collective, as in the experiences you got to share with those who really care and love the club. And there was great learnings in all of those. Probably the proudest, I think, though, would be the role with women's football, you know, at Melbourne Football Club. And, you know, I hate the notion of humble bragging, if you like, but I'm confident of that. Had not the people who were at the club at that stage had the courage to push forward the way we did in supporting, in trying to break the dogma in and around women playing the game, that we wouldn't have had the experiences that we've had in the last few years. And I was led to that. I certainly wasn't first to the game. I was led to it by Debbie Lee, who was our community manager at the time and a champion player and obviously a champion for women's football. And it probably was my time I spent with her where I realised I was spending time with the most committed football person I'd ever met in my life, because there was no aspect of my love of the game which was ever questioned, whereas her love of the game and her commitment to the sport were probably questioned from her childhood. And so that to realise that it was people like me, middle-aged white guys, if you like, who were holding the game back. And then once we got hold of it and started making some progressive moves towards it, and then enough to create a catalyst for the AFL and everyone else to then join in, it was a really important time in the game.
Yeah, well, Melbourne certainly have been pioneers with the women's game, and Debbie Lee's recently been made a life member of the AFL for some of the great work that she's done.
I rang her actually the morning she got nominated, and my father's a life member of the AFL, so there's real. I always show a keen interest in it, and I said I said you're different to every other person in that cohort of life members. And I remember, so she said, "No, there's been other women, and there have been, not many." You're the only one who's ever had to face into what you had to face into. You know, there have been women who have been given the opportunity of growing with the game and all that, but not women who had aspects of their character and they were mocked and all of the, and even, you know, a mocked is a kind word for it. But she was, it was the will, the power of her will, which finally built a platform from which the game could actually grow, of which we now celebrate. But I'm sure she didn't feel like that 10 years ago. I'm sure she didn't feel like that 15 years ago. And so her journey in the sport was one which was the most fraught of any person who's a life member of the game, whereas everyone else who's been there, it's just been an extension of something they love. They got to play it, they got to coach it, they got to administer it, they got to do it. Where all of those steps were very difficult for her. And I think that's, as much as we like to take credit for where the game's actually gone, we also have to recognise the challenges and the difficulties of those who have got us to this point, went through to achieve that.
Certainly. You yourself have had some real, you've had to be quite resilient in your time as a CEO in the AFL. I think you've been, and I know this is a powerful part of your story now, but you've been sacked twice as a, as a CEO. And I was recently watching Sunderland Till I Die, which is on Netflix.
Yes, yeah. And no, related to that.
Yeah. It was, you know, I think two coaches got sacked, the CEO got sacked. It seems to, sport seems to be a lot more cutthroat in that way, where if there's losing going on, just get rid of people. Is that something that, you know, is there not enough loyalty to leaders in sport, do you think?
I think it's, one, it's built on performance. So we have to always accept the fact that as a starting point, performance and the performance of your team, ultimately, you know, but it is your club. The performance of your team is dictated by a scoreboard. And the difference between, and I've even noticed this in running my own business, and we're involved in a similar place, that you and I can both do well in what we do, and rarely do we have to genuinely compete. There might be, every so often we might find ourselves competing for the same client or something similar. Whereas in sport, we have a winner and a loser every game. And the scoreboard is, ultimately is the number one. It ultimately tells the story, but it can actually be a distraction for all bar the very last phases of the development of a sporting team. And therefore, people can lack patience as it relates to that. And if it's not moving at a speed which is quick enough for those, well, you know, you're up for grabs, I think. And I know I was sacked twice, and I can say it's a lot harder being sacked than actually doing the sacking, as much as that is an unbelievably difficult part of the job. But I did also, during my time, have to bring some wonderful people into my office and explain to them that they're no longer coach, or they're no longer playing, they're no longer administrating. So I guess that I understood that from time to time, at some stage, the game was going to make a decision on me. Was that always going to be fair? Well, that was always that was then in the eye of the beholder, really. But it certainly tested me, because I'd managed to align just about every aspect of my identity to the game. So when all of a sudden it wasn't there for me, and the platform was as shaky as what it was, I wasn't in a very healthy place, unfortunately. So I had to learn to, and what I worked out is that resilience is not just a, there's certain people who are obviously born with greater level of resilience. But perhaps what I learned more than anything, it's actually allocating the right amount of emotional resource to whatever the challenge you are facing. And I think I overcooked that a fair bit. Mm. And in doing so, left myself a little bit bereft, both in regard to who I was and what was important, and because of that, I've probably learnt the lessons that, which hopefully are now valuable to the people who I get to speak to and spend time with.
Mm. Now the AFL at the moment, Gil McLachlan's described this time as probably the most challenging thing the AFL has ever been through, or certainly up there with one of the greatest challenges.
Yeah, that is, definitely.
What's your views on where the AFL's at now, and you know, how we can move the game forward and keep the momentum going?
Yeah, the game to this point was built on a certain set of conditions, and in any business, whether it's your business or my business, we need to have two pretty strongly interrelated models working for us. And the first one, we do need to have a profit model. The thing has to be able to develop enough resources to pay what it needs to pay for the thing to go around, and then it needs a performance model, and hopefully the performance model is such that it generates more wealth and it keeps building on each other, and that's no different in a football club. That if you, it's no point trying to get the performance right if you haven't got the business model right, the profit model. And so the AFL profit model or business model was built on a set of conditions which changed, and they changed, you know, really dramatically, and they changed in ways which, had it not been built on a platform which is probably the strongest in its history, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be cheering on 18 clubs this weekend. It wouldn't have, if it was happened in the time I was talking about at Richmond Football Club in the late 1990s, well, no, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have been able to survive it. So, yeah, it's been an unbelievably challenging period for everyone. And I think probably the most difficult aspect of it is that, and people might say the game's, you know, it spends too much money. But one of the reasons it spends as much money as it does is it's created careers for a whole range of people of which we hadn't even invented, you know, those careers, you know, 20 years ago. So I think the game should take an enormous amount of pride on the amount of people that it employs directly or indirectly. But now it's facing into that and saying, well, we can't do that anymore, you know, at least until such time as we can rebuild it. And it, whether it's going to be too much or too little, you know, we don't know. It's an unknowable future. It's an unknown and an unknowable future. So you can only make judgments based on what you understand them to be in this moment and what you think the future is actually, how you think the future is going to play out. And you're going to get some right and you're going to get some wrong. And I think that's probably, it's the unknowability about the future which has been as challenging as what it has. And but the game's actually survived, you know, world wars and in some cases just, by the way, it's survived world wars. And in surviving world wars, say at the Melbourne Football Club, there's four members of the 1940 premiership side were killed, you know. So it is an unbelievably resilient game. And I think we should take an enormous amount of pride in that. And it's the fact that the whole of the community has a means and a mechanism by which it can actually support the game now, both as athletes, being the players, and people who love the game, has really created that foundation.
I mean, at the moment, there's 5,000 people, they estimate, that have stood down or even just not there anymore. We can imagine that shrinking. Not all of those people are going to be coming back. How do football departments, do you think, look at the moment?
I was talking to people recently who have grown with the game, and they're on numbers. Obviously, the frameworks and the structures will be different, but they said it was like what we were doing or building in the late 1990s. You know, so that's how the numbers have changed. And so you, like any financial modelling relies on, you know, volume times cost. And so, you know, people are going to get paid less and there's going to be less of them. And, you know, how long that stays depends on how quickly the game returns in terms of its financial base. And generally what it does in times of crisis, I think we tend to overshoot a little bit. And you know, we've probably found that with the JobKeeper stuff, you know, that perhaps government overshot. And I think the AFL, you know, they've Richard Goyder is chairman of the AFL Commission, and he's also chairman of Qantas, and he's also chairman of Woodside. So he's got plenty of this remodeling and reframing of the businesses that he's associated with, and I spent a fair bit of time with him when I was CEO at Fremantle, you know, a lot of responsibility obviously falls with Gil as CEO, as it should. But he's got a wonderful safe pair of hands if he's looking to make that phone call just when CEOs need to make phone calls at different times. That Richard Goyder will be I'm sure he's on speed dial at the moment.
I'm sure he is. It's round two beginning tomorrow as we're speaking. Already there's crowds, you know, at some games at a small level, which is by far not what we were expecting by round two. So you're right, things are kind of coming back to normal, I think, a bit quicker than we thought. So, you know, hopefully the game can pick up and finances can pick up a bit quicker than we thought as well. So post-footy, you've evolved, and now you develop leaders through your business design CEO. How did that journey eventuate?
I think I lucked in, really. I think I was naturally the one part of the equation that I always was drawn to as a CEO was the development of people. I found that, and it might have even gone right back to the times when I was first in recruiting, we would draft players when they're only 15. So that was, you know, you're trying to project a long way out, and you're ultimately looking at both the character and capability of very young people, obviously, and as it might, you know, in some cases never get to actually play for another 5 or 6 years at the highest level. And then when I became a CEO, I saw that happening with some of the young people who then came through as administrators and coaches, and for instance, appointing Neil Danaher coach at Melbourne during that period. And I think then, and there was also an element which I always was attracted to in the conversations that I'd have with coaches is the, on the development of people. So I think there was a teacher instinct there right from the start. I didn't necessarily recognise it. And so the work I do now is effectively, when people ask what I do, I say I teach leadership. And I teach leadership based on a lot of the performance models and frameworks of elite sport, which I studied and got to visit some of the most outstanding sporting organisations and institutions around the world as part of that, and realised Australia did it pretty well. And it was a period of time where Australian sport was, you know, at a real high. And also built on the lived experience as well. So even in the conversations I have, I struggle. I find that I talk more about the setbacks than I do necessarily. And even when you ask me the questions, the things I remember are positive. It's not, I have to actually almost brush over my own history to remember which ones they were, because the ones which tend to stay with you were the times where you didn't show enough courage, or you were you didn't stay calm, or your ego took over. They're the ones that tend to stay with you, and perhaps that's the basis by which I teach now. And
it's a negative bias.
Might be.
I mean, certainly coaching and leadership and all those sort of things have really changed, you know, in the last decade, two decades, three decades, and
they have.
In sport in particular, can you describe that, how that's evolved?
Yeah, and well, I've probably lived it in some ways because I was a young CEO, and as you mentioned, I was 24 when I first had that role, and I was a young 24 as well. I wasn't any prodigy or by any means. I had probably a deeper football experience than most people my age would have had because of the way that I'd grown up. That I, you know, from the age of 10 or 11, I was sitting in my lounge room with my dad and Tommy Hafey, the great Richmond coach, almost replaying the game the Tigers had played the day before. And I used to sit in on that and not say anything. I realised that kids who don't say much, you know, can stay in rooms a lot longer than kids who say a lot. And so I was able to sit through that. So I probably had that experience in terms of pure football understanding, but didn't have it as a leader. And the people I looked up to as leaders had very much come out of the command and control way of thinking, because they were the products of probably parents who'd been to war, and that was, it was very military-like. And I love Ron Barassi. If one of my most favourite human beings in the world is Ronald Dale Barassi, and he's my first boss at the Melbourne Football Club when I'm 18 years of age. And never amazing. Never a more intimidating man have you ever met than Ron at that time. So I felt that's how you did stuff, you know. And so I tried to play a leadership game, which was some, you know, Frankensteinian, I don't know how you'd actually say it, you know, version of all the leaders that I'd actually met, rather than actually try to work out that it's actually, as a leader, it needs to be expression of who you are, and that's all the parts, and that includes being a little tad vulnerable from time to time. So, and I worked that out later, but not in a penny drop sort of way, just bit by bit by bit, because I was exhausting myself by trying to be someone other than who I was, and eventually started to have enough personal confidence and sense of myself that I could actually lead. And I like the creative side of leadership. I like the teaching side of leadership, but I also like the take responsibility aspect of leadership, that you could, there's going to be a time when, yeah, you've got to, as much as you want to be an empowering leader, and I love all that notion of it, but ultimately people also want to have trust in you that you can actually take responsibility when it's your turn, and having that judgment in and around that. And because I got to do it for 25 years, I got to practice it. So I got to stuff it up a lot and I was so fortunate to get more and more opportunities. And I think by the end, whilst you're always going to be judged by your outcomes, I felt quite confident as a leader, even though I recognised that there was every chance I was going to make errors and I was going to make mistakes, but I felt confident walking in the room, and I felt confident in that I could back up my judgment and these sorts of things. But gee, it was a long time coming.
Mm.
And so what I try to do with leaders is actually I think it can be taught. The stuff that we speak to now is no one taught me that. I was always having to observe and watch. Whereas what I try to do is create the leadership experiences that I'd wished I'd had the opportunity of having in lots of ways. So I didn't have to have the lows that I did. And the metaphor I use is a tightrope. It's a learned skill, but it's not outside of your capability, but you're going to have to learn it. And there are going to be times where you're going to fall over, you've got to go back to the start. All those sorts of things are going to happen. And I've really enjoyed it. And I've seen people, the amazing thing is I've actually seen people really grow and grow quickly. And it might just be based on one or two little frameworks that you've actually taught and coming back to that.
So you've been able to fast track, I guess, some leaders through that. One, I read Conrad Marshall's book, Black and Yellow and Black.
Yeah. Yellow and Black. You've got to get them in the right
order. Sorry. Apologies to all the Tiger fans. But it documented the 2017 season where Richmond basically went from being 13th on the ladder to premiers in 12 months. I think it's a book that everyone that aspires to any kind of leadership or even just loves team sport needs to read, outside of just being a Tigers fan, which I'm not.
I thought there was a Tiger scarf in the background. I know.
No, it's Hawthorne. Visual, it's Hawthorne.
Oh, okay.
I'm a Hawks supporter. One of the things that they talked about was this vulnerability that the players develop with each other. And I think it was called the Triple H, the hero, hardship and highlight that they each player would share, player would share each week. And they talked about it as a real key of they were still going through all the drills and all the physical practice, but it was this vulnerability, and also mindfulness was another thing they talked about.
Yes.
How have you, and I know you've talked about that, and I read your book More Than a Game, and you talked a little bit about vulnerability and that, but I mean this sounds like a revolution in thinking, really, when it comes to leadership.
It's an interesting thing because it's got to be, in the terms I used before, there's the things, my reflections in sport aren't the things I got right or wrong, recruiting the wrong player or recruiting the wrong coach or the right player, right coach. It is the times where, and I really focus on three things. The times where I didn't stay calm. So I got angry. And there's a natural sort of aggressive tendency in and around competitive sport. And sometimes it's a battle for airspace on who can be the angriest, and that leaves no space for anyone. And no one wants that. No one wants that. So I remember Neil Craig would always come into a meeting, and when we were at Melbourne, and we were going through some really difficult phases, and we were very good. One thing sport is actually great at is it uses the lived experience as a mechanism for learning. Even in a structural sense, that we play a game on the Saturday, we really don't move into the next game until about the Tuesday, even though the next game is always the context. So we draw as much learning out of the previous game as we can, both individually and as a team. And we use that as a platform so we can develop and give ourselves a better chance of winning the next week and the week after and building from that. Well, business isn't very, very good at that. So Neil Craig would often come in, even if we were, and say the business of the club, he would come into the meeting and the first question he'd ask is, did we stay calm? Did we stay calm? And if we didn't stay calm or we hadn't stayed calm, we're basically saying, well, there's no way known we could have handled that as well as we should have. There are almost no means by which we could do that. The second thing I often think about is the times where I didn't show enough courage, where the role that I played, the title I had, the car park I was given, whatever it might have been, the office I sat in, demanded that I was a brave leader. It demanded that of me. And often I was the only person who knew that I wasn't being brave. I could get away with it because you got position power at that stage. And I knew there were times when I was driving home, you had that sinking feeling, you go, I should have gone. I should have stepped into that conversation, and I didn't, because I saw something which was counter to what we're actually about. But I was intimidated by whatever the situation was. I was lazy, I was tired, whatever it might have been. And the third one was if I've let my ego kick in, and there's no lack of ego in sport, no lack of ego. So, and sometimes you feel, you know, and I used the term before, humble bragging or whatever it might be, you know, that you're actually, people are trying to position themselves all the time. And I fell for that at different times, don't worry. And so that, they're the things I often think about. So that's happening all the time in and around the game. It's like a whirl of those three things happening, and we've got to prepare for the next game and all that happens with it. And that doesn't, in the end, none of those things, you know, if they're not, creates no room for vulnerability. Mm. And it wasn't until, I think, people, and one of the things which out of the Richmond experience was that this group had actually spent a fair bit of time together. So they'd grown together, they'd reached a point, they got into the finals on a relatively regular basis, and they fell off in 1 year, and then they started, you know, there was a lot of introspection going on. And it required, okay, what does it take to go the next level? But that's not an unusual process. Success, yeah, grow, disappointment, then you rebuild. And almost most clubs have actually gone through it. The great Brisbane era, they were making finals, dropped away, end up making it. The great Geelong era, they were going well, dropped off 1 year, and they went. So it's not an unusual thing that they actually went through. But if they didn't use the experience of the drop-off to actually grow, that was almost the greatest failure as leaders, because there are a lot of good people there. And it was when they actually opened up and they could talk to each other, and this thing didn't require a wholesale rebuild. It was like, you know, the old graphic equalizers we used to have in our cars back in the day. You know, you used to put up a little bit of bass and move the treble up a little bit, and I want to bring the middle down a little bit. You know, it was more that. But that could only happen is if people were listening really carefully. Mm. And so when I think it was Brandon Ellis talks about his, you know, it gets a good run in Conrad's book. Because the three advantages of vulnerability, even at a strategic level, I'm going to say, well, one, and the thing I talked about before is how exhausted I made myself trying to be someone other than I was. Well, one of the great things about coming in and being prepared to be vulnerable is that you don't have to make up the human being you are every day. You can actually be you, you know, which is much easier. You still have to put boundaries around that. There are things that we don't want to, like, for instance, we do want to have a sense that our leaders know what they're doing. Like, if a leader walks in the room and says, look, I've got no idea what I'm doing, that's a step too far. You know, and Brené Brown talks about that in terms of how you put boundaries around the vulnerability. You just can't be crazy with it. But, yeah, just being who you are. The second thing is that stuff happens in our life of which we've got absolutely no control over, like none. I'm sitting here today, 2 months ago, I found out I had cancer, and so I've had surgery, my body's not quite right, all those sorts of things, I'm frustrated with it and all that, but I can't control. I can control how I respond to it, probably, but there's actually even a part of me saying, well, how much control do I even have over that, you know? Mm. So, I can't think of any reason why, any fault on my part why I've got cancer. I can't think of any fault. There may have been something I did at some stage, but I don't think so. It's just how it played out. And so we've got to be conscious of the fact that people are going to deal with things in their lives. It's just going to be how it is. And I can remember players playing, and we would almost push them out there in extraordinary situations where you knew there was no way knowing their head could be in the game. You knew that. In some cases, we pushed them out there because we didn't want to tell the world that they couldn't play, because we couldn't come up with a reason why they couldn't play, because everyone was going to say, well, how come that player didn't play? So it was a very difficult scenario. Mm. And the third one, and perhaps the most important one when it comes to vulnerability, is that it's actually an opportunity for people to help you, because you're creating a bit of a space. So if Brandon Ellis comes in and says, here's my thing, here's my stuff I struggle with, everyone in the room's going, I can help that person, or at least asking themselves whether they can. And if they can, they step forward. So not only are you finding out you're creating a space for someone to help you, you're working out who's in the room, who's prepared to help you. Both at a character level, as in that's something that they want to do, but also at a competency level, as in they've got something they can give you other than support. It might be their own lived experience, their own, you know, they may have faced into similar situations in their life. And the fact that we can have these conversations now as leaders, that's only happened in the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years. I would do a little bit of it as a leader, because some of my losses, if you like, were quite public. But my father died in a public way, and he was a high-profile person. And I knew that for the next 10 years, there wouldn't be anyone who I met in the game who wouldn't think of my dad when they were talking to me. I knew that. Mm. So I had to talk about it in one way or another. But not much. not much. And that's why you see this beautiful stuff come up with Ron Barresi talking about his dad when they talk about the Anzac game now, because he was only 4 when his dad died. And there's this beautiful piece of footage where he says, "What I remember is my mum crying. That's what I remember when he was 4 years of age and his mum got the news that his father or her husband had been killed in Tobruk."
And that sort of brings up, you know, there's been a lot more players and coaches addressing mental health. I know Wayne Schwoss, he's done a lot of great work around mental health of players, and there's been, you know, many players that have come forward and said they're struggling and been given time off. I mean, that's something that just, you know, would not have happened even five, six years ago, it would seem.
And it's a big change. And again, a platform of people. Sorry, cut you off then. But you going to say something?
No, that's all right.
Yeah. So, yeah, the platform which is now being created for that, I think we've got a long, long way to go too. Don't worry about that. Because even as a player, people say, okay, I come out and I explain this is how I feel. I'm not saying it makes it any easier for them, but they get to come back into the team, play and perform. But if you're a coach, how do you do that? If you're a CEO, how do you do that? And yeah, I was treated for depression for 20 years as a CEO. And I used to walk into the Albert Road Clinic with a hoodie and hoping that no one saw me. I'd be sitting in, and when you're a CEO of an AFL club in Melbourne, you're sort of a semi-public figure, probably. And even if they could, you know, your name when it was called out, when you're signing your Medicare thing or going to the chemist to pick up your drugs, I was terrified that people were going to find out that I had depression. I'd always been treated for depression. And I now talk, as I have here, quite openly about it. But I'm not sure. People will say, well, would you do that if you were a CEO of an AFL club still? And I probably wouldn't.
Is there,
your judgment's being questioned.
Is there, you know, is it looking back now, is there any advice you'd give your, you know, 24-year-old self with the lessons that you've learnt around all of this?
A lot, I think the main one was it took me a long time to source, you know, where it was probably coming from as much as anything, why I felt the way that I did. And I got wonderful treatment, and we've got as good a medical system as you possibly can to go through that. But it's changed a lot, even in the time that I've worked through it. But the number one thing is don't align your well-being to some created identity for yourself in the way that you do. That it's actually okay to be you. And you're going to get it right and you're going to get it wrong. You're going to make good judgment calls. You're going to make poor judgment calls. But as I mentioned before, that resilience is about, in my mind, this is only my take, is sort of almost the allocation of the appropriate amount of emotional resource, if you like, to whatever the issue was. And I overshot that the whole time. And the competition sort of does that a little bit, because it's always going to be demanding of you. But it was still, it certainly got unhealthy and quite devastating at different times. And often my reflections are that, you know, I've talked about two personal, or probably three deeply personal elements to my, or four when you can, being sacked. So being sacked, losing my dad, finding out I had depression, and recently finding out I had cancer. Well, only one of those I kept secret. You know, I find out I have cancer, and I first thing is, who do I speak to now who can help me? You know, which of my support group, my family, my best friends, the people who are closest to me, I'll tell them. Why? Because I know that they will reach out and want to be able to help me in some shape or form. Whereas the other one was, I remember driving away thinking, who can I trust to actually tell? Who needs to know this? And really, you know, it took me a long time to even tell my brother and my sister and my mum. You know, the people who were quite, took me forever to tell them. You know, even when I told them, it was 10 years later, probably.
You're right. There's so much more stigma around illness when it's mental illness than when it's a physical illness. It's seen as some kind of weakness or whatever. I think that's changing a little bit, where it's where people are starting to see it as a strength when people do come forward.
And congratulations to Wayne Schwoss, and congratulations to everyone. I remember, I think it was Andrew Robb, you know, as a politician. I remember Gallup, the Premier of Perth, basically handed it over, the premiership of his state. You know, as a result of it, you know, I think we're seeing it in different forms now. And the other thing is just to finish off that little conversation is there's a wonderful book called Lost Connection, and and when I read it, there were times I had to almost put it down because I just felt that and the person's experience, everyone's experience with mental illness is different, but their experience was enough, similar enough, where I could say, yeah, that was, I felt like that. And it was really, without putting too fine a point on it, and some people, certainly the medication is really valuable, so I would never underplay it for that, is that it is sourcing where it's coming from for you is the challenge. And so my antidote, if you like, is the things that I felt that mental illness was doing was taking away my sort of energy and attention, my capacity to stay focused and maintain an energetic approach to life. So I worked on all the things which gave me those. So if I was having a conversation with the younger version of me, it would be, what are the things that you really give you your energy, and what are the things that enable you to focus your attention? And I would have held on to art and writing and things like that longer. I gave a lot of that up as part of the other journey that I was taking.
And you are a great illustrator, and I love some of your illustrations in your book. How did you come back to it? How did you integrate it back into, really, you've integrated into your business and your story?
And probably the work I do now, is the good thing about it is it can be a full expression of who you are. And the full expression is, as a kid, I was always drawing. And if you ring my mum and what was Cameron like as a kid, he either had a foot in his hand or a pencil in his hand, sort of stuff. It was the other two things. And my mum's an artist. She wasn't an artist when I was growing up. She took it up a little bit later, but she's a very good painter. And my dad was a footy administrator. So that shows you the sort of the nature nurture thing in
a nice image.
Lots of ways. And so I loved superheroes growing up, so I was always drawing Batman and Superman, and then I loved the Richmond Football Club, so the players became my superheroes in some ways. So most of my art's quite figurative in that way, and I do the illustration stuff's more, I like bringing to life old images in the game, but my art, my more pure art is probably more storytelling. And and it's interesting because I ended up studying fine art at the Victorian College of the Arts. So kind of go back to your question, is it was actually at the time when I lost my career, when I got sacked at Melbourne, is I realised that there was probably no opportunity for me in the game anymore, and I needed to find some expression of something that I really loved, and I thought it would be art. And it's hard to be a full-time artist, and so I've integrated the two now. But I ended up studying full-time at the Victorian College of the Arts, studying fine art as a first-year uni student. And I had a wonderful lecturer and a great artist. His name's Raf Ishak. And I remember him coming to me at one stage and he says, "Oh, you draw like a CEO." He said, your art is like the CEO. It was like the ultimate put down for an artist. he was saying that you're trying to close out the conversation. Whereas he said, in my view, in my opinion, you know, the great art creates a conversation, and it doesn't seek to be definitive as to what the answer actually is. And I found that out when we were studying. Some of the great artists would go into the National Gallery and we'd break into groups and we just look at one painting for a couple of hours, and the different groups would have a very different interpretation of the same piece of art, and you realise the genius was in the conversation it created and the depth and how it made people think. And so part of my art now is how my take on something, or in other cases how I go about, you know, creating a conversation. And I think quite deeply about it, and I now have almost a system by which I can give myself an opportunity of doing art that I enjoy doing.
I think your website is it's just beautiful the way it's designed. Yeah. I love your illustrations in your book. It really brings out the story and the picture that you're trying to create. So I'm glad you've managed to integrate that into your business.
Thank you.
Lastly, as we sort of close up, what keeps you productive as a business owner?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that, and I love the line, we don't rise to the level of our ambition, we fall to the level of our systems. So I'm a big believer in that.
Part of your book, yep.
Yeah, that you build a system. So I'm into routines and rhythms, and even the process of creativity for me is a system. Is it, coming from a place of curiosity, is a wonderful start, and then having a quite a structured system of collection. So if there's an idea I like, I record it quickly. If there's something which I've seen, even if it's in social media, it goes into Evernote. If there's a line or a quote or something like that, I collect it. And then I do have quite a deliberate process where I curate my knowledge. I do that through either drawing or writing, or seeing what I can do. And I find that the writing in particular then leads to a creation of some of your own thoughts, and where you might be using the most recent book you read or the quote that you liked, you're aligning it to your own take, and then you get to create something which is unique to you. And that requires you've got to have sort of hours of uninterrupted work to do that, And I'm not saying like you've got to sit 6 hours tomorrow. It might be an hour here, an hour there, and each experience builds on the last one. And so even with my drawing now, there's one I did more recently. It was just an old man having an ice cream. It sounds really weird, but it's one of my favourite drawings. My stuff's on my website, Design CEO. But I'd started the drawing 3 years ago, but I had a different idea and a different take, and I sort of dragged it out and started it all over again. And I think it benefits from the 3 years. It doesn't, obviously each of the efforts played a role in it.
Mm.
And like a lot of this stuff, it's what we actually leave out, which is often the most important thing. And the final incarnation of the drawing was what I left out, which gave me the pride that I was prepared to park my ego for long enough to get rid of aspects of it, which were so technically not bad, but added nothing to the drawing and the story that I was hoping that it would tell.
Mm.
And that all came out of studying art, and probably in the same way, and also studying performance.
Amazing. All right, well, thank you so much, Cameron. I really appreciate not just the generosity of your time, but also that you've been so vulnerable with me and your story as well. Okay. So I really appreciate that.
No, Fiona, thanks very much for the work you're doing too. I know that it's it could be a little bit of a thankless task from time to time. So there's probably a whole lot of people out there appreciating the work you're doing who you won't know that they're appreciating until sometimes you run into someone and they go, oh, yeah, I know your stuff. Yeah, that's fantastic. And I really thank you for it. There's sort of a whole lot of silent people who I'm sure getting a great deal from your commitment to the game and your commitment to learning.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.